You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to another thrilling episode of the Toilet of Hell radio show. I am Joe Thrashenkill. With me, I've got 365 Days of Horror, or as I like to call them, Jordan. How's it going, Jordan?
It's going well. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing especially well because we have an episode here that it's great. It's a great episode because it doesn't really feature us in any significant way.
Those are really the best episodes, if we're being honest.
It's a double bonus. I don't have to do anything, and I get to listen to a really good interview.
It works out because, you know, sometimes there's just weeks where there's not a lot going on. There's not a lot of news. There's nothing really happening. And this was kind of one of those weeks where we have to kind of put our heads together on like a Thursday night or Friday morning, just be like, did anything happen that we can talk about? And sometimes an interview just falls into our laps and makes our lives a whole lot easier.
And not just like any interview either. Like, this is one that I think is pretty great. On last week's episode, we talked about the new version of Slayer Jr. or whatever. And we were, you know, kind of scratching our heads trying to figure out who would be an adequate replacement for Tom Araya on bass. And it's funny, a Toilet Hall friend of the show, Justin Davison, like reached out and he was like, you know, I immediately thought of Joey Vera, because the dude has like an impeccable rock resume. And just out of nowhere, Ian's like, hey, I'm doing an interview with Joey Vera.
Yeah, if you listened to a couple episodes ago, our interview with Moonspell, Ian did that one as well, and he is slowly becoming our old man interviewer, our man on the street for some of these interviews.
Yeah, if you guys didn't listen to that Moonspell interview, you ought to, because, damn, Ian's really good at this.
He is a professional, he has done lots of recordings, and, you know, he is a fan of a certain age, which works out when it comes to talking with some of these musicians and bands that are kind of around the same age frame who have an understanding of musicianship and have a lot of history that you can dig into. And you'll hear it on this interview with Joey. They like really go back to the very beginning of Armored Saint, which I think you might not notice it just because they've been around for so long, but they started in 1982. So there's a lot of history with this band.
Yeah, and I would say that, yeah, Armored Saint is one of those bands that maybe, you know, you wouldn't have any kind of contact with them if you, you know, came up in the nu metal era, like a lot of us did, or after that, if you're some kind of freak that's younger than me somehow. But, yeah, if you hang out with metalheads of, as you said, a certain age, that's a touch point.
I mean, and they get into it on the interview talking about how they're like kind of a thrash band, but like kind of a heavy metal band and kind of have like little elements of glam touched in there a little bit. And it's how they started in the LA metal scene really in the early days in the beginning, and subgenres kind of sprung up around them, and they were in like trying to do their own thing. And when bands started teasing up their hair and putting on the mascara, Armored Saint started to wear armor on stage for like a couple of years and a couple albums worth, and like power metal didn't really exist at that time, and they were just kind of trying to do their own thing. And for a while it worked, but as all these scenes change and evolve, it started not to work, and then just kind of becoming like a t-shirt and jeans band and things like that. It's a nice piece of history, not just if you like Armored Saint, but if you're interested in kind of the origins of West Coast and American heavy metal.
Yeah, and I would, you know, this isn't, his work spans more than just Armored Saint as well. I remember doing that episode with John Arch a couple of years ago, and Vera has a long history of working with both Arch and Fate's Warning. I mean, he's been all over the place with those guys for the past, I don't know, 20-something years.
Yeah, I kind of think of Joey in bass playing similar to someone like Gene Hoagland, who is just a drummer for everyone, it seems like. It's kind of like he's the steady hand that's like, if you need bass, go with Joey. Because he's done Armored Saint, a whole bunch of albums. He's done a bunch of Fate's Warning albums. He's done a solo album. John Arch, Arch Matthäus, Seven Witches he's played with. And he's actually, like, as of this year, Merciful Fate's new bassist, which is kind of amazing.
That's about the coolest gig I think you can get. There is no cooler gig in my mind in metal right now.
I'd really have to think about it a long time to think if there would be one that was cooler. I mean, I suppose being the new bassist for Metallica might pay you more. Yeah. And that's kind of cool, but just from a musician standpoint and stage production, and you know people are going to see you live, like, that's kind of one of the top bands that you'd want to play with.
Yeah. And also, Joey and Armored Saint were featured in Hellraiser 3, which, as we all know, was the last good Hellraiser movie. So overall, kind of a top-tier career so far.
I kind of question your usage of the word good when describing that one.
If you will recall, Hellraiser 3 had both a rotating body totem pole thing, and as we all know, the best Cenobite, the one that launched Deadly CDs.
And now that Cenobite is technologically out of touch.
Yeah, it sucks.
You need one that shoots MP3s or something.
It's a little bit tough. You know, the MP3 monster, I think, is being deprecated as well in favor of the FLAC Cenobite.
You could really hear the difference with this Cenobite.
I don't know if anybody out there has, you know, suffered through every single Hellraiser movie, but I think that you can tell an obvious decline from 2 to 3, and then from 3 to onwards, it's just unwatchable. So I'm glad that Joey got to participate in, as I said, the last good one.
He left his mark.
I'm stoked on this one. I'm stoked to hear what Ian put together, and I'm glad to share this all with all of you.
It's a good interview. Lots of history, kind of lots of interesting things about metal in general. They talk about the band's new album, Punching the Sky, which is coming out October 23rd on Metal Blade Records. And for those of you that really like gear and tone talk, there's a good chunk of this interview towards the end where they just talk about his bass tone.
Hell yeah, brother. I assume that you tuned out for that part.
I nodded along like I knew what everyone was talking about. I mean, despite not like being a guitarist or a bass player, I can understand what someone means with like your tone. It just doesn't sound the same as some of your older stuff, so that makes sense. But, you know, once you start talking about pickups and gains and channels, I kind of feel like Homer with the monkey in his head clapping up the cymbals. That's kind of what it's like for me.
Well, as we all know, tone is the most important part of being a musician. You don't need to bother yourself with theory or songwriting. If you get tone, everything else falls into place.
And, you know, you got to have the giant half-stack amp. That makes all the difference.
Yeah, if you don't have a full stack, I mean, you can't even call yourself a musician.
You might as well be playing second on a 30-band show at FET.
Damn. Well, what do you say you and I get the fuck out of here, and we listen to this this very good interview with Ian and Joey?
I think that's a good idea. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, at Toilet of Hell, at Joey Thrashingkill, at 365 Days of Horror, and even though he's not here, at Breno Grounded. Is that it now?
That's it.
Okay, that's it. And hit us up on Patreon, patreon.com/toiletofhell.
All right. Enjoy the show, folks.
Bye.
With Joey Vera of Armored Saint. How are you, Joey?
I'm doing well. I hope everyone else is okay out there, yourself included. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I suppose that's how all of these conversations have to start these days, is how are you doing? So how are you guys doing?
We're good. Like we're dealing with life as most of us are in this whole world. Just luckily, at least in my circle, everyone's here is healthy and dealing is okay with everything so far. So that's good. The rest of the guys in the band are good. We're just, like I said, we're just trying to move forward and be creative and continue to try to be somewhat normal during this time. We're hanging in there.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. You've got a new album that's coming out. This is a hell of a time to have to promote a new album. How is this impacting the plans you maybe had in line for that before all of this happened?
Well, everything is kind of business as usual as far as the record release part of it, other than not being able to do let's say like a record release live gig or something like that. But everything else is just moving forward like normal. We did talk about, because we were putting this on the schedule, it was right around April or May, and we said, well, should we hold it, wait and see what happens with the world, But, even the us and the label were kind of like, well, why wait, what are we waiting for? Maybe more than ever, because people are sort of locked in, maybe more than ever, this is a better time to release it. People just want to feel some sense of normalcy, and they want, and if you're a music fan, a new record from one of your favorite bands is the perfect thing, So people are genuinely seemed excited that we have a new record coming out, regardless of what's happening in the world, maybe because of what's happening in the world. I don't know. So, we didn't really have any touring planned for it, so it's not like we really lost out on that aspect of it. But just the fact that we can't play is a bummer. So we are remedying that by, maybe we were going to talk about this or not, but the idea came to us to do one of these sort of virtual live streaming shows. At first, we thought it was a terrible idea. The idea of going into a venue with no fans allowed and playing on stage and pretending like you're playing live seemed very odd and awkward to us. But the more we thought about it, and the more it became to realize, this ain't going to change in the near future. So it's either you do something like this or you do absolutely nothing. And the thought of doing nothing to us really scared us. We didn't want to do that either. We have this record coming out. We want people to be pumped up, and we're excited about it. So we said, let's just do this. It's going to be different and weird, but let's think positive, and it's going to be fun. So we're doing this show. It's October 10th. It's when the live stream starts, and it runs for a whole month. You can watch it from October 10th all the way to November 8th. We're playing in an empty venue, but we got a bunch of cameras and, sound and stuff, and fans can come watch us play on stage. It's only $10 to get in, and we're playing a full set. We're playing four brand new songs from the record, and we're just going to have fun with it. So if anyone's interested, they can go to Armored Saint. That's one word, armoredsaint.veeps, veeps.com. And we hope people will join us, and it's going to be fun. We're going to answer questions and stuff from fans that are submitting things they want to know from us. And, it's a strange new world at this point. Hopefully it gets back to normal at some point in the future. So for now, this is what we're doing.
Well, I think it is exciting. You can count me amongst the people who are excited to get a new album from a favorite band. And, my ability to go out to shows and be out till 2 a.m. is very limited, even in the best of times.
Yeah, there's a lot of places we've actually never played. There's a lot of, or maybe if we've played near a place, like even in the United States, let's say, forget it, never mind the world. There's a lot of places we haven't played in the world, but and all the times we've toured the United States, some people are like, why don't you ever come up to Vermont, or, you know, why don't you ever come up to, you know, Delaware or something, you know, or, you know, you never play near Montana or something. Look, that's true. There's a lot of times tours just don't go to certain areas. And so for this way, people, doesn't matter where you live, you can come in and watch us. We're going to be rocking out like normal. And this is the closest thing we're going to get to making that happen. So here's an opportunity.
Well, before we talk more about the new album, one reason I was pretty excited to talk to you was just a personal memory I have about getting exposed to Armored Saint in the late 80s, I guess it must have been. And I totally misunderstood you. So basically, the store, it's hard for young people to understand, I think, what it was like to go to a record store and not really know what you're looking at. You know, you could either had money for a magazine that would tell you about a band, or you could take that same money and roll the dice with something that had a cool album cover and looked maybe kind of promising.
Exactly.
So Armored Saint was definitely in that category of, I don't know anything about this, but holy shit, look at this. There's fucking, you know, knights on the cover here. This is absolutely for me. Got it, loved it. But I honestly don't know for how many years. I just thought you were a British band. You know?
Well, I mean, that makes sense because you were talking about March of the Saint, the first record.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, at that point, well, we are heavily influenced by British bands, especially the new wave of British heavy metal, when that was one of the big things that really kicked us in the ass. But yeah, it makes sense. We were very much influenced by anything UK related or European related. So, you know, the fact that we named our band Armored Saint was part of that, you know. We were way into Excalibur, the movie, and, you know, we just wanted to go play Donington Festival. That's our dream, you know, or the Marquee Club in London. So it makes sense that would come across that we seemed like we were British.
Yeah, it did. And then I was shocked to find out LA. And then I thought, right, actually, Can You Deliver? Like some of those other tracks started clicking. I was like, of course. There's a Southern California thing going on. Yeah. Again, I honestly thought it was Brits imitating that sound. but what was it like for you trying to work in that scene really in its heyday when, you know, you were bringing something distinctly different to the scene?
Well, it was pretty fun. We, especially being in LA, we were, you know, part of this new metal scene that was emerging. And we were just there. We were one of the younger bands that was coming up that got signed in late 83. So we were stoked. I mean, we were just part of this new scene, and we were trying to do in LA was we were trying to bring some of that stuff that we were reading in Kerrang! Magazine about, you know, the bands that were playing the Marquee Club and stuff like that in London at the time. We were trying to make that happen in LA. So we were one of the first bands that were more the sort of the denim leather bands than anyone else. There was a small handful of other bands that were akin to us too. But, you know, we were dealing with like the bands that were already kind of already getting bigger, but were more glam oriented, you know, even Wasp and Black and Blue and Malice, you know, there were some other bands too, Rat, of course. And we were playing with those bands, but we were way more denim and leather, you know, way more influenced by Saxon and Def Leppard and Motorhead, you know. So that's what we were trying to bring to the scene in the city. And we feel like we were definitely part of that first wave, you know. And it was pretty exciting. I mean, it's also strange to look back, though, because at the time, like, I don't know if I really appreciated it, you know, like it was just normal. It just seemed like, well, it should be like this, you know. you had no idea that at some point, like, you know, it would turn into the Poisons and the Guns N' Roses that would just like explode beyond, you know, even though I wouldn't call that heavy metal, but it came out of the heavy metal scene. And the it almost got to the point where heavy metal got too big, you know. And we had no idea it was going to go that way in 1982 and 83. You couldn't even conceive of that. But it was cool. When I look back on it, I look back, you know, with a fond memory. It was pretty wild, and we felt like we were part of that Wild West, and it was cool. It was fun.
Was there ever a moment, you know, just in private where, I guess I'm wondering, like, how intentional was your positioning as the Denim and Leather band? Was there ever a moment in the practice space where, like, you know what, let's see how we look in eye makeup and spandex. Maybe that's something we should try.
No, it was never that, but that kind of conversation is kind of what led us into wearing armor in our first 3 or 4 years of existence. Because when we first came out on the scene, we were basically just were reproducing what we were looking at from bands like Saxon and Iron Maiden. And next thing you know, there's other bands coming up doing the exact same thing. So suddenly you're playing with other bands that, you know, we basically kind of sounded the same. And then we also kind of looked the same, you know? And so we sort of felt like, well, we were also really into theatrics, and we were into bands that were very entertainment oriented. Bands like Kiss was a huge influence on all of us from the 75 until, you know, Kiss Alive 2, I would say. And then, bands like Alice Cooper, you know, David Bowie. We were really into a lot of different kinds of bands and music, and the whole spectacle part of it was something that we also really liked. So we said, well, we have this cool name for our band. Maybe we should be exploiting this vision or this image that it kind of could conjure. So, you know, we were also at the time very much into the Road Warrior, the first Road Warrior movie.
Oh, yeah.
And so those things kind of came at a perfect, you know, planets came at the same time. And then we said, let's do something different. Let's try to separate ourselves from the pack, and let's go for this kind of post-apocalyptic armored, you know, slash, you know, Road Warrior thing. And that's where the armor came from. And so that was the moment we took that step, and we said, let's try to be different from everyone else. And it worked at first. I mean, I thought that it was a really cool thing, and people really dug it, and it was it did separate us and made us a little bit different than everyone else. But that came back to bite us in the ass a little bit later, when the genres began to splinter, and you started to see subgenres come in to the scene that were not really there before, thrash metal being one. Then you could say, I don't even know if power metal was a thing in the early 80s. I think that came later. But then you had the glam metal scene, which was clear. And so we kind of found ourselves at times struggling. And I'm talking like once we were already signed and we were touring around the States and being on tour with different kinds of bands and stuff. We found some audience members sort of like, I don't know. They look, I don't like the costumes. I'm getting the costumes. I'm really into the t-shirts and the denim vests from bands like, you know, Slayer and Metallica and Anthrax or whatever. I'm not getting this whole dressing up in a costume thing. I don't care what your music sounds like, you guys, I'm not getting the image, you know? So it took us till about 1997 to finally go, all right, enough of this, you know? It kind of got in the way. And the most important thing to us the whole time was the music anyway. So we said, the music is the only thing that matters to us. Let's drop this whole armored thing and just be a band. And so we went back to just being ourselves.
I think it's really interesting that you experienced the emergence of subgenres and what that did in terms of audience tastes and, you know, markets for live tours and things like that. One of the aspects of Armored Saint and a lot of the bands of that era that I don't see a lot of now is a diversity in terms of the lyrical themes or imagery that you've got. So, you know, for Armored Saint or a lot of, you know, Def Leppard for that matter, a lot of early metal bands, they'd have a song about sex, they'd have a song about politics, they'd have a song about fighting dragons, and it didn't seem like they needed to specialize and, you know, just be a political band or just be a dragon fighting fantasy sort of band. How do you feel about that narrowing of themes that seem to have occurred sometime, I don't know, around the emergence of thrash, where there wasn't this wide diversity that you got in the new wave of British heavy metal bands?
Well, it's an interesting point to bring up because it's kind of part of our story that of how we've evolved. And we, at the time, you know, in the beginning, we just, like I said, we just wanted to be a European British influenced band. But along the way, we were always into different kinds of music. And part of the bands that we also were influenced by were even earlier than the new wave of British heavy metal. So we're talking about like bands like UFO, bands like Queen, Thin Lizzy, let alone other kinds of music like R&B, for instance. So we slowly began putting in different influences into what we were writing and doing. Now, once the splinter started happening of these subgenres, it kind of came out of nowhere, and you sort of felt yourself like, I touched on this a second ago, where you were sort of you were turning some people off and turning some people on, but also some people weren't getting it. And so we sort of felt ourselves swaying between the genres. We could hang with the thrashers and we could hang with the hair bands. We could do both. But we never really fit in with one or the other 100%. We kind of had started drifting towards the center. And believe it or not, around 1987, the later part of our Chrysalis years, they began to weigh on us. And I think we started to feel this sort of sense of like of an insecurity and just an unsure. We were starting to become unsure about who we were. You know, a little bit of an identity crisis. And I think it started to affect the way that we wrote music. We started to overthink things and we started to overanalyze songwriting and themes and stuff. And in my opinion, anyway, a lot of people disagree with me, but I think that it started to hurt the music. And, you know, this thing sort of bugged us for a long time. And it really wasn't until I would say right around 2009, when I was writing for La Raza, that I was looking around at our career and saying, you know, the whole time we've always sort of done our own thing. We've kind of been on our own island. And why was that ever a problem? You know, I mean, this is something that we should relish. And this is something this is what we really wanted to do in the first place. We just maybe weren't sure of ourselves enough, or we were getting pressure from the record label and management to be, you know, focus on one thing only kind of a thing. I don't really remember what was fueling this kind of insecurity, but this is the big step we took right around 2009. And I said, we're on our own island and we should be exploiting this. This is what we want to do. This is what we've always wanted to do. So we suddenly had this sense of like this pressure relieved on taken off of our shoulders, and it allowed us to be, I think, able to be a more of an honest band and more music that we really want to write, and, you know, appreciate and show the things that I think that we do well, and some of the things, you know, that we want to do, take chances, you know, let's bring in some R&B flavor here and there. You know, we love it. Why not? You know, let's try it. We might fall on our flat on our faces, but we might succeed at it too. So, this is the place that we've become. This is where we're at now. So, I think in a roundabout way, I'm answering your question.
Oh yeah. And I think, you know, how much of this is also the story of you growing into the role of a producer and engineer, you know, struggling with these issues of, you know, the nuances of sound and positioning the band in this way or that way, or carving out your own island?
Well, I guess that's part of, it's a big part of it. And I'm not afraid. I mean, I'm a little bit humble. I don't really like to toot my own horn very much. But, you know, it is part of, I am a big part of that. I'm the guy who is waving the flag and the battle cry. And I'm saying, guys, come with, trust me on this, you know, we're going to write some great music, and it's going to showcase one of the best singers in the whole industry right now, which is John Bush. And he's in our band. Like, come with me. It's going to be awesome. And we're just going to write great songs and great music, and just come with me. I have a vision, and the vision pays total respect to what Armored Saint is and or was, and I'm never going to tarnish it. It's only going to make it even more special. Trust me, just come with me, and it's going to be great. And so I'm lucky that the guys in the band trust me in that sense. You know, I mean, we all work in a collaborative way, but at the end of the day, somebody has to be the director or leader or you know, producer, you know what I mean, or manager. Mm-hmm. And I've taken it upon myself to be that person. I think that I'm pretty decent at doing it. I'm not perfect. I make tons of mistakes all the time, but I'm willing to be open enough to see the big picture. And you know, it's a growing process. I'm learning stuff every time we put out a new record. And here we are now. This is just another snapshot of where we are mentally. And this is a snapshot of where we are at this point in our career. And I don't know. I'm hoping that the fans and everybody connects and understands it. I think that for the most part they do. And we're super lucky to have all those people that are coming along with us, the fans and everybody. So this is, we feel that we're in a good place right now.
I think that's incredibly humble given the audible results. But for a lot of fans, especially fans who are maybe thinking about getting into record production or doing it for themselves at home, you know, the shame is that you don't hear all the stuff that got deleted. You don't hear all of those learning moments because, you know, why would you put them out?
Yeah.
Is there any kind of, and you don't have to answer this question if you don't want to, but is there any kind of huge mistake you remember learning from?
Let's see. I don't know. I mean, not really a huge one. Not a monumental moment, let's say. I mean, there's plenty of things, you know, that have sort of gone wrong, or maybe we made wrong decision wise along the way. I mean, our band has evolved. We've been around a long time, you know, and I've known John and Gonzo since we were in the third grade. So our history is so deep. It goes back so far. It's very hard to work with people that you have are basically family to you. It can be very difficult, but it can also be very rewarding too. So we cherish that we have the same members that we have had for a very long time. Now, when we were younger, we didn't know a whole lot about anything. And to be honest with you, we didn't really fucking care, to be honest with you. Didn't care about the industry, didn't care about business, didn't care about how anything worked, didn't care about having any control over your own destiny and your own business life or anything. We just sort of thought, that's what managers are for. That's what the label's for. You know, I don't need to think about that. That was probably a mistake. But yeah. I think younger kids now are much more savvy than we were when we were 18 and 19 years old. So that was a mistake we had to learn the hard way. We probably lost a lot of ground. We never got to go and tour Europe until we were off of our major label, which was a travesty, and that really hurt us. And we probably could have fought harder to make that happen, but we kind of, you know, let the management and label you know, tell us otherwise. They'd say, oh, it's too expensive. You're not going to get anything out of it. You know, we were like, what? We need to go tour Europe. Like, this is, we've been, Kerrang! Magazine, look, you know, it's happening over there. And they're like, nope. And so that hurt us, you know, and like I touched on before, you know, we let outside influences get to us while we were making the record Raising Fear. And even though a lot of people love that record, it's a strange record for me personally. I feel like we were a little bit confused during that time. So, you know, I just feel like nothing really monumental would be a mistake, you know. It's a lot of little things. And everyone's going to make them. I mean, you know, that's the beauty of life is this is how you learn. You know, you don't come out of the gates like with all your ducks in a row all the time. You know, you have to stumble and you have to get up and you have to get over those hurdles and learn from them. And you got to be willing to take it on the chin every now and then. And I think that's the thing that you will make you a better everything, better songwriter, a better writer, a better musician, a better person, better father, a better husband, you know, all those things combined. This is the only way you can get through life is to try to do better next time.
Sounds like a bumper sticker worthy of a car right there. So let's turn to the new album. And I've only heard the single so far, End of the Attention Span. And one of the things that I'm pleased to hear on this and, you know, gosh, as far as I can tell, like literally every Armored Saint album is part of your, you know, subliminal appeal is these big backing vocals. I think, you know, of course, you know, the music performances, the shredding, all of it is good, but there's something to me super satisfying about the way backing vocals are done across the Armored Saint catalog. And so my first question about making this new album is just about that kind of consistency. And if I don't, am I just a weirdo who's the only person who's thought this hard about your backing vocals, or is this, you know, something that's on your mind too?
That's cool. Not a lot of people mention that, but I get it because it's superly. There's a new word. It's superly intentional. It is something that's conscious from my part, and I've tried to bring in as much vocals as I can. Maybe it's my love for Queen, I guess, coming through. Certainly not, again, we're not attempting to be Queen by any means here, but influence, sure. I mean, I see backing vocals as another instrument, another part of that sort of orchestra that has their own part that can play a part in moving a song forward. So that's very much intentional, doing that. And I feel like in the last three records, we've had more of that than we've ever had in our career, you know, not just limiting the backing vocals to sort of shouts or, you know, harmony parts on certain sections. Like, I've been trying to orchestrate parts that are integral into the chord changes in a section, let's say. So this is something that's very much a conscious decision. I'm glad you pointed out, because I'm pretty proud of it. I'm proud of it being part of the song and part of the instrumentation. You know, all of our records, that I think when I look back at each of our records, each one is a little bit different than the one that came before it, you know. And this is another part of me accepting that fact. You know, I never want to make the same record twice. So this record is no exception. I feel like we went even further and took some other chances on this record than we did on Wind Hands Down. But by the same token, I want to have some things in the music and in the sort of aural landscape that reminds people of our band, and where we maybe some of that reminds them of a past song they heard or something like that. But I'd also want to take a move forward in another direction and show them or showcase, you know, something a little bit different. So for me, like, my mentality going into writing new records is kind of always the same. Let's just write, and this sounds really dumb, but let's just write great songs. You know, it's very non-specific, you know. Let's just write great music, great songs. I'm always attempting to have great choruses. So is John. This is something that, to the extent of our conversations about writing, involves these few topics: great choruses, big hooks. It's got to be epic and huge, you know. So I'm really into lots of overdubs and layering, and the vocals are a big part of that. So I'm glad you noticed that, because it's very much intentional, for sure.
And what are these areas that you're exploring now to the new aspects? I see you've got a pretty big engineering team again on this. How is that part of your efforts to, you know, innovate and move forward?
Well, the engineering part of it is a little more on the technical side, with maybe the exception of the very end of Jay Rustin's input. But, you know, once I'm done with the writing process, I guess real quick, I make very elaborate demos when we're writing. Mm-hmm. And so I will take the song that we're writing and I will play all of the instruments on it, all the guitars, bass, everything except vocals. I even put dummy lead tracks on there, program the drums to make it sound like an actual drummer playing. And I spend a lot of time on it, and it's very elaborate. And so at the end of the day, I've got a pretty clear idea about how I want it to be at the very end of the day. So once we get to that stage, we move into the production side of it. And I wanted to bring back the same team that we worked on with When Hands Down, for the fact that I really loved the way that record went on the production side of things. I loved the people that I worked with, and I loved the end result, and I wanted the same environment. I don't want the record to sound exactly the same, but I wanted the environment to be the same. So that's why I hired Josh Newell and Bill Metoyer and ultimately Jay Rustin, who mixed it in the end. And so I want to work with these people because I trust them. I respect their work. I want their opinions, and I want their feedback on everything along the way. I want them to bounce ideas back and forth with me, like, was that a good take? Is that good enough? Or can it be better? Does that sound okay? Could it be better? You know, I mean, I don't have all the answers along the way, so I want people to help me fill in the holes. And all three of these guys bring their game to that. And Jay Rustin, at the end of the mix, when it comes to the mixing stage, I just tell him, look, you know, here's some general, like, make it epic. Like, you know, I'll give him some very vague idea, you know, make it dangerous, you know. But I want to hear his interpretation of what we're doing. And so I'd say 9 out of 10 times he comes back, like, right on the spot, like, wow, that sounds great. You know, I wouldn't have thought of doing it that way, or, you know. And so this is the reason why I chose these people to work with. And it's a really cool collaboration that I owe them a lot to this. They're a big part of the end result.
Yeah, just having an objective ear during the creative process like that, especially when you've been living with it since the pre-production phase, maintaining perspective is so difficult.
It really is. And by the end, I mean, I'm so sick of hearing these songs by the end that I'm like, oh my God, I can't even tell anymore. Is it good? I have no idea. I used to like it, but now I'm starting to not like it.
Seems like a good idea 6 months ago.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, and that's why you're like, okay, look, I gotta walk away from this. And so, you know, it is a tricky thing. And that's why along the way I'm able to stand back and look at the big picture and say, okay, give me your honest opinion, you know, and and I'll listen to it, you know. So,
well, now I want to turn to dorking out about bass for just a little bit, because one of the things that I'm hearing in the new single is it sounds to me like you've got a different bass tone. On previous albums, I would say you have a very rounded sound, but on this one, I'm hearing, you know, there's more of an aggressive high end clank on there. I love it.
Yeah. I have been going in that direction for quite some time, actually. I've been pushing that, like, I don't know. I guess I'm in this endless pursuit for the Geddy Lee bass sound, I guess. I love Geddy's sound on each record. But, you know, I also want it to be my own, too. So I've been pushing those things along the way. But to be geeky for a second, I did do some things different. What I did was I didn't use an amp at all this time. It's 100% direct, and the signal chain is a little too complicated to.
Well, are there explain. Multiple channels? Are you doing one for the the flank and one for the body?
Yeah, it's super divided up. I had an absolute clean sound, which is basically just straight off of the guitar. However, I don't particularly like DI sounds at all. So what I used was a Tech 21 Sans amp, the original Sans amp, the black and yellow driver. Mm-hmm. And so I am coloring the DI track a little bit, so it's not just totally clean. So it's just kind of a flat signal, though. It's got a little bit of not too much low end in it, certainly not a lot of high end in it, and nothing really happening in the mid range. But it's fairly clean, but it's got no distortion on it. But it sounds like a clean SVT, kind of, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that's the DI track. Then I run a parallel out of that into another Tech 21 Sans amp, the VT bass driver. And that one has a lot more color controls as far as EQ goes. So that one I'm making a little more ratty. And that one has more low end. It's got some dirt on it. It's kind of like a slightly overdriven SVT. And so that one has a lot of body, and it has way more mids, and it's got some more top on it as well. And it's got a little bit of fur, a little bit of distortion on it. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third track that's also on a parallel out. And that one is something I got recently, which is the Dark Glass X7. And that one is super crazy. I mean, that's just got tons of top end, tons of distortion. And it also has this sub distortion that you can blend in, which is independent of the mid-range and the top.
Ooh.
It's pretty cool. And so that one is offering, you put them all three together, and it's a pretty trippy thing, because you can blend them to make it sound really different for each track. And I think that's what Jay Rustin did, was he would use, depending on how he perceived the rhythm section, he was using one or more of those particular tracks I just described as the driving force for that song. So each one's a little bit different, but that's what you're hearing is you're probably hearing just the certain combinations of all those three elements.
I'm absolutely loving it, and I've always enjoyed, you know, when I was a kid trying to learn how to play bass, one of the reasons why Armin Saint was in the playlist was like, I could just hear in the mix. I couldn't get a Slayer mix and figure out what this bass was doing. It was just useless to me. But then what happened to me, and I'm asking you as a bassist of a certain age who remembers the 90s.
Yeah.
As soon as I had mastered, you know, just straight 16th notes, and I was thrilled, all of a sudden, there's like Faith No More and Red Hot Chili Peppers and Primus, and there's all this slap bass happening.
Yeah.
And it was so, I can't tell you how many years of my life I wasted learning to cover those stupid slap songs. And never again in my life has that been useful or popular or cool you know, in any arena that I've encountered. I'm basically just asking you about the 90s slap bass trend and how you made it through it.
That's hilarious. Well, I got into it. I did get into it, and I play with it all the time. For me, it's fun. I've always been into funk and R&B growing up as a kid in the 70s. So some of the influences that I had growing up, even when I was a late teen, was Larry Graham, Louis Johnson, Verdine White. And Verdine didn't really slap that much, but so those guys had a big impact on the way I play, period. I mean, even still to this day, I carry those influences, you know. A little bit later, I got into Marcus Miller. And so those are the guys that really influenced me in the beginning. And then when I heard Flea, of course, Flea put it in a rock context. And then I thought that was cool as shit, you know. Armored Saint never really did much of that. There was a song called People that we wrote, which is an unrecorded song we wrote in the late 80s, I think, right around the time I got into Chili Peppers. And that song is clearly influenced by Chili Peppers, and I get to slap a little bit. I wasn't very good at it at the time, but I think that record, I mean, that song appears as in a demo form on Not to the Old School, which came out in 2001.
Oh, really? It was called People?
Yeah, I believe it's on Not to the Old School. Yeah, it's a song called People. And that's clearly a Chili Peppers influence song. And also, I got really, at the same time, I got into John Norwood Fisher from Fishbone. I'm a huge Fishbone fan ever since. Where we were musically, and Armored Saint broke up in the 90s, so maybe that was a good thing.
That's what saved you from having to seriously contend with the trend.
Yeah, that's exactly what, by default, it saved my ass from having to, like, feel the need to keep up with those Joneses there. But I, on the side though, I mean, I still practice slapping and I still love it. I'm frankly a little bit like, I see it all over Instagram, and it's like, sometimes it's annoying. Or if you go to the NAMM show or something and everybody is slapping and popping and they're all trying to do it faster than the next guy, and it's so non-musical. And that bums me out. So I just have fun with it. I like it. It's fun to do, and I still trying to get better at it. And that's my slap story.
It's starting to sound like you might be gonna put out a funk on R&B album or something in the near future. Are you really thinking about it?
I've definitely toyed with it, just doing something more instrumental. But I don't know if I would go out with a full on R&B record. I mean, John and I both love R&B, and we actually talk about it all the time. Like, we should write an R&B rock record, you know. But I'm like, yeah, I don't know. It's not the right time, you know. Let's wait till let's get this Armored Saint thing out of our system first.
Well, out of your system, let's wrap up with talking about you're staring down 40 years of doing this. That's a lot to have in your system.
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. I feel very honored and humbled and grateful that we've been able to do this for this long. And we've had support from a lot of different people for it to happen. The fans being one of them, our record label being another one, our support systems at home. You know, we're very lucky to be able to make music, and we're lucky that people want to hear music from us 40 years in. You know, back when we were starting out in the garage, you know, when we were 18, 19 years old, that's all you really wanted. That was success to you, you know. So we feel like we've done it. We're successful. We're doing it, you know. It's pretty cool that we're, you know, some of us are nearing 60 years old at this point, and it's like, what? And we're still playing in Armored Saint, and people want to hear music from us. That's like, it's just beyond us. So we are so grateful and thankful that we're able to do this. This is all we really wanted to do in the first place.
I think it's amazing the way that this has just naturally become old folks' music. I remember being a teenager and, you know, grown-ups trying to tell all the metal kids, you'll grow out of this, as if we were just going to, you know, turn 30 and suddenly like the Beatles and Bob Dylan. And meanwhile, we're planning a Motley Crue cover bands in the retirement home in 2040 or something.
Yeah, exactly. You know, hey, strange things happen. This is one of them.
Absolutely. Well, Joey, I really appreciate you talking with us here on the toilet today. Is there anything else you want to add before we leave you?
I guess want to remind people to come check us out in this live stream, and we're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to getting back to playing in front of people. And thank you to all the fans again. Can't thank them enough for supporting us and giving a shit about us. We just can't do any of this without you guys. So thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Looking at me, pour a mouse and air out my love.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.